Welcome into the Waiver Fire podcast. Nick Smith, we are back. We have a special bonus edition of the podcast. We are going to be talking with longtime friend, Sam Phillips, first time on the pod, old friend. And we've dabbled in the book club and we thought, hey, we have a play. It's just Sam and I. Let's throw this on the pod and talk a little play critique. Sam, how's it going, big dog?
It's going okay, Nick. Thank you for having me. I will say that I've been nursing a gnarly head cold over the last 2 days. I've been home from work, taking Benadryl. So I'm groggy. I'm a little sleepy, which is the right conditions for excellent pod content.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm so stoked that we get you in that form, as tough that is to end. You know, before we get into the play, which we're going to be critiquing, if you will, Glengarry Glen Ross by David Mamet.
Yeah.
And I know that through the film. Many of maybe the listeners know through the film, famous early 90s film with just an all-star cast.
Al Pacino, Alec Baldwin, Jack Lemmon.
Yes.
It's a few others.
There's a few others. The guy who did the who's the painter who splatters the paint?
Pollock. Ed something.
Ed, who played Pollock in that film that I have not seen before. Anyways, we're gonna, if you don't mind, I think we should try our very best to hold off on the film comparisons and give the play its due as much as it's so hard, but. Well, I guess before we get to that, have you seen the film before?
Nick, I just finished watching the film about 5 minutes ago.
You're in it then.
So I'm in it. I had never seen the film. I knew vaguely what it was about, but it was one of those movies where you just like, I figured I'd see it at some point.
Right.
And then as like streaming has caught on and like things have gotten harder to find, like I've just never like opted into it. And so, yeah, the movie is very fresh in my memory. And then I, finished the play yesterday.
Okay.
And are you familiar with David Mamet? Any of his other work?
I'm not, and we'll absolutely get there. Let me first give you just a minute if you need it for a eulogy towards your basketball team. If I know that was hard last week and, you know, we have a sports fan base here. Can you give your boys just a little bit of either love, hate, whatever it takes for you to get that off your chest once and for all for this year?
Yeah, so I grew up with Nick in Auburn, Alabama, but currently reside in Oakland, California, the proud former home of the Golden State Warriors, formerly the Oakland Warriors. And so I will say that I was very proud of their push this year, after a very tumultuous beginning of season, when Draymond Green, my favorite player in the NBA, dramatically punched Jordan Poole in the face. But they've been pretty up and down, pretty dog shit for long stretches of the
right.
And I will say they gave us two iconic series in this year's playoffs. Their run against the Kings, I thought was phenomenal. They won, but more so than that was just a great, you know, the Kings hadn't been to the playoffs in many years. Two local fan bases, head to head, great, you know, grizzly, gritty players banging each other up. And then you have the Lakers and the Warriors in the second round. Another iconic matchup, LeBron versus Steph. I don't think we're going to see any other series this playoff year have that level of entertainment value.
Ouch. That's, wow. That's, they burned bright early and it's just downhill from here. That's tough.
I'm pretty sure that's right, because I foresee the Denver Nuggets going all the way, maybe even winning the whole championship, going to the finals. They're, I think they're kicking the Lakers' ass as we speak right now. And like, I don't know about you, Nick, but I find that team has very limited charisma. You know, Jokic is not like, he's no Steph Curry. He's no Klay Thompson. There's not, I mean, he's a good player, great passer, tall guy, but I wouldn't say he's like, you know, he's got that celebrity shimmer that
kind of reminds me of the Russian Soviet Union boxing villain from Rocky III. Is that the one?
Yes, I know who you're talking about. I can't in my Benadryl'd out state, can't pull the name.
I think it was either Rocky III or Rocky IV, where they just had that stoic ass, chiseled Soviet Union badass. Jokic kind of reminds me of that a little bit, but he needs to lean into that a little harder if he's going to.
Ivan Dragic, right? Isn't that?
Oh, I was going. I'm not sure.
Maybe Dolph Lundgren was the guy that played him, but yeah, no, I see it. I appreciate the pull. So I mean, I would say those are my flowers. I'm excited for the rebuilding season. This is my first, you know, I'm a new sports fan. Growing up in Auburn,
right?
I didn't really watch college football, and so I've been a basketball fan for about 1.5 years, and I've seen two postseasons. And last postseason, the Golden State Warriors went all the way. So this is my first sports fan hurt. Nursing those wounds, and listen to a lot of podcast content to kind of speculate on what's to come next year. Yeah.
Hey, appreciate that. You know, we're always here for you, man. If you need that, you know, that shoulder to lean on. But let's dive back in to the main subject. And you had asked, was I familiar? And of course, Sam, you know the answer. I was absolutely not familiar. So if you want to kind of give me the David Mamet experience that you've had so far.
Well, I mean, to be honest, I haven't had a ton of intimate experience with David Mamet. He, you know, he's a playwright that worked out of Chicago in, I believe, the 80s, and also became a screenwriter. So he's made a bunch of movies that I'm sure you've seen.
Oh, shit. Give me a little taste.
Okay, so we're talking House of Games. You ever seen that one? No?
Sorry.
Okay, Heist with Hackman, DeVito, Delroy Lindo. No? Boy. Okay. I'll give you two more. Untouchables.
Okay.
And what's another prominent one? There's a bunch, man. If you just Google it, he's deep in there.
I imagine that's a pretty common transition, playwright to screenwriter. I mean, it's right there, I would guess.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there have been a couple of instances where he's adapted his own work. You know, some we can talk about, you know, the comparisons between the movie and the play later in the episode. But I mean, what I knew about him, having not been that familiar with his work, is that he dropped a lot of F-bombs. There's a lot of cursing.
Kind of known for the F-bomb, huh?
Known for the cursing. And then also known for, this might be something I'm making up and pulling out of my ass, but I think he's also known for the ellipsis. So just dropping in some ellipses in the dialogue. You saw that in this play where there would be just
prevalent
pauses. And sometimes you're like, I don't even know what this guy is saying because there's just so many ellipses. And so I think that's a trait of his work as well. Also a dude's like a writer of men, you know, so not a lot of like strong female characters in his work. I think there was zero women in this particular play.
I think we got one offshoot, which, you know, we'll get into it, but I guess before, you know, let's give our listeners just a little taste if they're really unfamiliar. We've got a play that focuses around some real estate agents who work in the same company. They've recently been kind of prodded by upper management to have a little friendly competition to see who can bring in the most cash. And what do they call it when they take a cut of the sale? Cannot remember.
Kick out or to go on the board.
They get a cut of whatever they sell. It's like they're whatever. Yeah, whatever. Anyways, they have a little competition and it turns some folks a little pissed off. A lot of emotions are running high. That's the premise of the story. And that was going to lead into, I think we do get one glimpse of a female in the whole production. And that's a wife who basically is chastising her husband to not buy some of this bullshit real estate. And that's the only taste you get that we get. And that's through only through dialogue. So,
and the other dynamic is that there are a few characters who are older and they're like 50s.
Yes.
Who are like a little long for the tooth, maybe had their heyday in the salesmanship game earlier in their career. And then some younger 30s, 40s aged characters who are rolling. There is the threat of people getting axed if they don't meet their quotas, they don't get up on the big board and win that Cadillac. I know we're not talking the movie, but I can't remember in the play if they dropped the steak knives. In the movie, they say first place is a brand new Cadillac, very desirable gift, and the second place is a little kit of steak knives. And then if you're not on the board, you gotta be sent home packing.
I don't mind that that second place drop off. That's classic, and I like the heightened. I think that lays the stage, man. And just give it to me, man. What are your thoughts on this? Did it kind of fit the mold that you were thinking or going into it? What are your just overall thoughts on this one?
Well, I thought about this play. We were looking for a short read. We had just come off a couple of plays. In our last book club session, two things stood out to me. One was we had a conversation about kind of classic dramas that include like family dynamics and everyone's like, you know, angsty and throwing, you know, the mashed potatoes across the Thanksgiving table. And
exactly.
That genre exactly. Being kind of played out. Right. And looking for something a little bit newer, fresher, whatever. And then we also had a conversation about going to our gyms and sitting down with a dude who is trying to upsell us on getting like personal fitness or something, or staying with the programs. And so those two things kind of blend in my mind. And I was like, oh, I have never seen this movie. I know what it's about. Mamet is kind of like a more modern writer. And this is about the upsell, the art of the sell, always be closing. So I thought it was appropriate. And in terms of my top line thoughts, I guess one thing that stood out to me, not knowing a lot about the play, is my copy has in red letters on the front, winner of the Pulitzer Prize. And so that kind of raised the stakes for me a little bit. I was like, okay, I know this is famous, but this has gotten some acclaim. And I started reading and I enjoyed it, but I will say that it's not particularly, I didn't find it a particularly easy read. I think it's like something that you really need to read two times or read kind of slowly, just because of how Mamet writes. He writes with all these pauses. He writes with so much crosstalk where like there's like four conversations happening between characters and you don't always know what the fuck is actually going on. And then also he's like immersing you in this world of salesmanship. So he's dropping all this lingo. So you're like the first act. I mean, there were moments that were very clear to me, but I really felt like it required a little bit of slow reading. What do you think?
Agree on many fronts here. Thank you so much for picking something that kind of, dude, you're absolutely right. We spoke about the gym upsell and them putting you in the back room and being like, just all of the bullshit and all of the kind of emotional weight they throw at you, and couldn't get that off my mind when reading. So appreciate that tie-in. I agree that the dialogue, and it's not just like the back and forth. Sometimes that's, you know, there's two kind of complex behaviors going on here. The first one is when you've got multiple chatter going on, which is pretty frequent. You know, the real estate agents might be in the same setting and they're just bouncing off of each other. Oftentimes really not listening to each other. Sometimes kind of listening halfway in their own dialogue. And so, which I think is fantastically real. And I appreciate that, you know, coming off of Tennessee Williams last week, where you have these just insanely formal speeches that they give to each other. You know, somebody takes the podium. Okay. They relinquish the podium to the next person. So that's really exciting and refreshing and difficult, to your credit. And then the second complex situation is when somebody just, you know, one of these agents just goes on a tirade about whatever it is, whatever, you know, it's almost like the first thing that comes to their mouth is just, they just keep it rolling for like 15, 20 sentences. And that can be murky to dig into, but I think the juice is worth the squeeze and it's exciting. So big fan of it. You know, lots of specifics to talk about. I will say high level as a story and as a subject, there are very few professions that I despise more than real estate agents. So for them to kind of get fucked a little bit here is just really warm hearted for me. And it's just awesome because I think that, you know, it'd be one, I don't know what it was like in the early 80s. Maybe you really did need somebody to kind of scout out locations or whatever, or hear about things that hop on the market. But bruh, everything is online now. I bought three houses, and every single time I found the house before the real estate agent, and I had to pay them whatever their cut is for nothing, in my opinion. So that's just my personal bias. And so for them to get theirs a little bit in this production is just awesome. That's just an aside.
If I could cut in for a second, like, I do think that, you know, the salesman, man, I've never been a salesman. Have you been a salesman?
Let me think about that.
I mean, I sold popcorn in the Boy Scouts. That's about as close as I've gotten to having to lay it on thick.
That's the closest like cold call I've gotten. But I guess when I was a consultant, I would never like sell, but I would try to kind of upsell a little bit. Like once I was on campus, I'd be like, oh yeah, we can get this done. But you know, you might also want to consider this. I dabbled a hair and just hated myself every second that those words were coming out of my mouth.
It's a very foreign industry to me. And to your point about certain areas like real estate or whatever with the internet, it's kind of almost become a dated thing.
Right.
But I will say it's like the subject of some of my favorite stories.
Mm.
Like, I've always been a fan of Death of a Salesman, that play that we read in high school. I've always been Wolf of Wall Street is like incredible. You know, I just watched this amazing documentary called Salesman. By Albert Maysles, and it's all about people just like this, but they're selling Bibles, like big like Bible sets. Gotcha. And so they're in the documentary, they're like in their suits, like smoking, like laying that down cash, talking about their tactics, and they're going in and like, you know, trying to put on airs of being like a holy person. So you know, I love a good salesman story. Because
I can't disagree that it's incredibly dynamic and engaging, but it does almost always put me in a kind of uncut gems level level of discomfort where I'm just like, I just feel so bad that these people, you know, they're just like in this play, you know, I would say our main protagonist is a struggling older quote unquote salesman who's feeling the burn and the pressure. And he frequently references his daughter as kind of the reason why he does it. I don't know how much it's so hard to like trust the emotions that these people try to convey or whatever, but to take him at his word, it's like, yeah, he's trying to fucking feed his kid and put his kid through college. And the only way he knows how to do that is to be a ratty motherfucker and snatch money out of people's pockets for, and I'm judging a lot here because we don't know what real estate they're selling. I get the impression that it's some just piece of shit thing in Florida that's like really terrible, but that's just my cynicism. But you're right. Salesmanship, it's engaging and it's exciting and thrilling, but God damn, it's just dirty and gnarly.
Yeah, that's the character you're describing is Shelley the Machine Levine, who is
Shelley the Machine.
Shelley the Machine. And that was also my favorite character. Well, I had a couple favorites, but you know, that's definitely the person who I sympathize with most. Because earlier in his career he was on a hot streak and now he's run dry a little bit. And so yeah, I appreciated him. And even more so when I saw the movie, because I feel like, I know we're not there yet, but he's portrayed by Jack Lemmon. And just, I feel like across the board, Mamet's words, they need to be spoken to really be appreciated, because it all makes perfect sense when you see it in front of you. And especially with that character, Lemon brought so much like little nuance to the dialogue.
I agree. I would love to see a real production, a stage production of this to really understand. And I think you might be able to see it many different times, because to your point about how he does use the ellipsis to really, really structure the dialogue, tells the actor, okay, after the sentence, pause, for what different reasons, different pauses. But one thing he really doesn't do that Tennessee Williams did pretty extravagantly was really go into the setting, staging. And I mean, Tennessee Williams, we talked about it last time. He not only will tell you, hey, I want big ass red maroon flowers here, but I want them to convey the blood of the innocent or whatever, and Mamet does not, he does not lay any sort of, I don't think he lays any stage except to say Chinese restaurant and real estate office or whatever. And so it'd be exciting to see how different directors could pull off different stuff. You could go incredibly minimal or you could go really realistic. But to your point about hearing the dialogue, it would be just wonderful, to hear the three or four folks bouncing each other off. And yeah, I agree. I don't want to talk about the movie, but I have thoughts on Jack Lemmon's portrayal of
word. Well, let's save that. So we got Shelley the Machine Levine. The other prominent character is the guy that's on the most heater of any of the sales people, and that's Roma.
Roma's hot right now.
Who in the movie is portrayed by Al Pacino. But what do you think about his, one thing that stood out to me about his tactics is that we really get to sit in on his cell. And his cell is so much more like bizarre and kind of almost like mystical. I don't know exactly how to describe it, but he goes on these, like, you call him a tirade, but he goes on these long circuitous journeys with the people that he's selling to. And then he like just very swiftly at the end pulls out the brochure and that pen and closes the deal. What do you think of his character?
I thought it's one of the top introductions in a play that I've ever read, where you get him at his fullest. And I love that you actually get introduced to him with a dot, dot, dot into his speech, like as if there was already 15, 20 minutes of this guy just like going on about, I mean, he says so much stuff. What does he say? He's like, have you ever like shat that made you feel like you needed to take a nap or something like that? Like he just says all of these things. And I love his kind of client who's just a random person eating at the Chinese restaurant in a different booth. Like he's being verbally assaulted over here. He just tries to like squeak in a word like, me? Like, what are you talking to me right now? And then by the end of it, you're right. Like, he's got this guy just so engaged, like, who is this wild man? And you have to imagine that, insanity, verbal insanity, like from a homeless person sounds a lot different from a very clean cut Al Pacino in a suit. It can be incredibly dynamic and engaging. So I thought he was dope as hell. I thought it was a great introduction, and I didn't see the sell coming, to be honest. I was like, where are we? Oh, we're selling Florida real estate at the end. Okay, very cool.
Yeah, I mean, I interpreted his like crazy tirade to basically be a version of like, you only live once, like YOLO. Other sales people do in their own way. And I don't know if we get it in the play, but definitely in the movie, you see some of the other sales people get on the phone and go on a longer sell, but it's so like stock and kind of, I mean, they're both performances, but they're sort of more by the books and they don't work. And it's really this like selling of hope and dreams and, you want to elevate your life and be all that you can be. And that selling of the dream is really what makes these salespeople their money.
Agreed. And I think it's really tactfully done. And I like, after we get that initial besides his like rant or whatever, it's a pretty quick little sell scene. but we just get so much development of the interactions off of each other. And I'll be honest, quite a few of the characters, and maybe this is kind of on purpose, they kind of like run into each other a little bit in terms of their personalities. Like who are we following here? And I think that's, I think that that's somewhat intentional from the get go. I mean, we get our little cast of characters on page one, and all the description we get is this group is 40-year-olds. This group is 50-year-olds. And so they're from the get go, we're lumping these people into basically similar structures. And I think that's fine. It's confusing to know who, but regardless, their dynamics, and again, it's hard to trust what they really feel, but when they start to show some amount of like morality and brotherhood and kinship a little bit towards each other, I think that's really exciting. And Roma's like kind of, holier than thou approach whenever he goes into the office, like, do I really have to fucking deal with this right here? This is just amateur hour, left, right, and center. Like, I'm way better than this. I think it's fantastic. And I really enjoyed it.
One thing we haven't talked about is kind of the central conflict or mystery in the play, which is that this office is basically leveraging the contacts that people call to make their sales. And these contacts are called leads. And so for the better salespeople, the people who have sold the most and are on this big leaderboard, they get these premium leads, which in the movie are these this little stack of red slips with people's names on it. They're the Glengarry properties. And these leads are people with more money or people that will pick up the phone more or whatever, just better contacts. And then the folks that are on the lower end of the totem pole get like basic leads that are like dog shit, basically. And they feel like they can't escape the being at the bottom without the privilege of the better leads. And so two salesmen connive to basically rob their own company, Premier Properties, and take the leads and then sell them on the side to a competing property manager. I didn't really know who that was.
Not a property manager, but a real estate agent who's kind of a solo act. And yeah, towards the leads themselves, you know, the whole mystery of who done it. I don't know how exciting that is on first read, because again, I had watched the movie, and it does the same kind of plot point. So I knew who had done it, I guess, or I figured it would be the same. So that I wasn't really chasing towards the end. But what I love about the leads in the play is that we don't get to see upper management. We hear about them. What is it? Mitch and Murray. Like, we constantly hear these people kind of reference the upper bosses, but we never get a taste. And I think that's awesome. We'll get in the movie about how they bring in Alec Baldwin to be the big daddy or whatever. But I love that. I love that there's this kind of unknown, and you know, they throw the little morsel of bagel bread and have the rats kind of go at it amongst themselves. You know, I really enjoy that. So the leads really, you know, it's just there. It's a perfect little anecdote for anything. I think a lot of professions have this, where it doesn't have to necessarily be a mild competition, but you know, people just kind of turn on each other quicker than I sometimes would have ever thought possible in a lot of tough situations. And, you know, I guess my feelings, and maybe this is naive, is that maybe the world's getting a little bit better about that. Like, it's not as, kill or be killed kind of situation. Like, it's a little bit more chill, and there's a little bit more humanity in the workplace or whatever. Maybe in some ways that kind of anger has shifted to start pointing towards the Mitches and the Murrays a little bit more in the world instead of at each other, which is probably a good thing. But that's just my naive, you know, that's just my opinion of, but anyways, that got a really like a little tangential right there. But I like the leads, and I think the play, honestly, the whodunit part of it, I mean, it kind of tells us right from the get-go, right? Like you said, Levine and Williamson, they kind of say like, hey, let's steal them. And there's the plan. And you don't necessarily.
Wait, not Williamson, because Williamson is the, that is an important character.
Right. Not Williamson.
You don't see Mitch Murray, but we do see this middle manager character named Williamson, who basically it's his only task at this property group is to create the carrot and stick structures to keep people in check.
Right.
So he's the guy that's like coming up with this competition. He's the guy that's like sending out the leads. And he gets he's the recipient of some pretty stern words from the other characters. Because he's like the ultimate obstacle for most of them, especially Shelley.
Yes. Not Williamson, but Aaron Hour, whatever. So the actual mystery, go ahead.
Well, it kind of is, because when we were first introduced to it, it's Moss and a character named Aronow or Aronoff.
Yeah.
And they're talking about it, right? And Moss is like, he's the one that came up with the idea, but the way that he pitches it to this other character, it's almost like he's making him, he's coercing him to basically go in and steal the stuff, right?
Wow, dude, I feel so ignorant looking back to your point about needing to reread. I thought that was Levine and Aaron Al. Wow, that's Moss who's originally.
Yeah.
Okay, so that, and maybe
it ends up being a little bit of a surprise at the end.
You're right. And so that was unfortunately probably having seen the movie, I kept just picturing Levine is going to steal this. So I just forced him. Moss and Aaron Hour are the actual ones who are talking about it. Interesting. Okay. Well, then in that case, the whodunit is definitely a more of a twist towards the end. And that, I think that's somewhat exciting, but I guess I like more of the actual symbolism and kind of the, values, I guess, that are trying to be pulled out of there.
Yeah. Have you ever, you mentioned this a little bit, but have you ever worked at a place that had a intense leaderboard like that, like a really intense incentive system?
No. My first job, there was just the three of us, and there was some amount of hierarchy, but there was certainly never a peer, comparison. And then in this position, I basically am in the one and only. So no, I've never been in a position where there's any amount of comparison, and quite honestly, an insanely little amount of yearly review or whatever. Which there is technically supposed to be a yearly review, but it hasn't happened in the past couple of years, I guess. And when it does happen, it's like, nice job, Nick. I'm proud of you, big guy. You keep it up. So I've never felt the fire before. How about, I was going to ask, I don't know how personal you want to get, but how about yourself? I know you've worked mostly in education, but is there a kind of,
not known for its cutthroat tactics?
Well, I don't know. Never been there myself. Yeah. My only taste of kind of education is through Hollywood a little bit. And I recall in The Wire, if you've ever seen The Wire, they go pretty deep into some inner city schools with teachers. And the feeling is basically, hey, you need to do exactly what the state tells you to do, or you're going to get canned real quick, and you can't be going out on these limbs and stuff. So I think there was a lot of pressure, but
certainly, there are so many dynamics politically around the ed world that are super cutthroat and intense. But I've been fortunate enough to not be immersed in a lot of that. My first job, my first full-time lead teaching role, was at a school where they did try to implement some of these tactics, where the more gentle version was recruiting teachers to our school. You'd get a bonus of a couple thousand dollars if you brought them in. So there was a little bit of competition there. Hmm. The thing that really drove of people, including me, kind of crazy, was we had this this public leaderboard, more or less, of all of our tasks that we were supposed to do, which included the lesson plans that we were writing, or any emails we were supposed to send, all of our tasks. And if we were late on any of our tasks, our color would go from green to red for that task. And so every week you'd get this long ass Excel spreadsheet of everybody on staff and where they were at with their deadlines. And Yeah, that was, it's pretty fucked up.
You know, I do have something almost exactly like that in my current work where we can see a similar kind of to-do list, but everybody knows that the shit's going to get done. So even if it does go in the red, it's like, there's more of like a, hey, do you need help to get this done? Like,
yeah.
There's no amount of like, oh my God, Nick, yeah, it's yeah. 3 in the red right here. So I don't know.
I'm totally down with that. And at my school, there was like, people would gossip about it. They'd be like, Susie was like, yeah, 3 in the red or whatever. Yeah, it was pretty bad.
And I honestly don't know what, you know, I think you and I would kind of maybe tend to agree that, you know, it's somewhat private, you know, business or whatever, but married to a Chinese lady who was, you know, born and raised through the Chinese education system. And that is very much a public, you know, Sam, you're number 350th in our class. Nick, you're 362. You know, it's a very tiered and public ranking of people from early ages. And I don't know, on a personal note, it seems kind of fucked up. On a societal level, maybe it does kind of inspire. I'm guessing that it probably inspires more cutthroat, you know, eating of each other than it should or whatever, but maybe it does kind of push people towards their best in some ways. I don't know, but it certainly doesn't seem to really, it doesn't really seem to, I mean, I was going to say, it doesn't really seem to fuel these real estate agents to do any better or worse in terms of, you know, selling, but whenever they do make a sell, they come in and they're like, put my name on that board. I want that Cadillac. Like, they talk as if they want the prize. But I wonder if that board system had never been, you know, if they would have still made the exact same number of sales or whatever.
Well, I think that, you know, I think they do want the Cadillac car, but more they want to be seen as like men. With like, but they want to have that power. They want to have that like dominance. You know, Levine comes midway through with a big sale, and he sits Jack Roma, who's or Ricky Roma, who's the lead salesman, and goes on this like, it's basically like a big fish story where he's just like, oh, this is how I did it. This is it. I was eating this crumb cake, and this is what I said to her, and you know, it becomes this like, performance for him of his like, you know.
Oh man, it's totally the cigarette after sex moment where he's just like in heaven, feet are propped up, and he gets to feel so great. Yeah.
And I love, I mean, this is like, we're totally spoiling this. So if anybody's listening that hasn't seen this movie, I'm sorry, but I think that the, one of my favorite moments, it's so gutting, is at the end when after all that with Levine, it's exposed that his big sale was actually to a couple who were lunatics who are living in kind of squalor and who just liked to call up the agents so that they could have somebody to talk to, and that their check for 80K was just it was gonna bounce.
Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, I believe this gets revealed after Levine gets caught.
Yes.
You know, around revealing that he's the one that stole all the leads. So it's like a double twist of the knife.
It was really a double tap to the head, no question about it. You say that it was kind of a crestfallen, you know, sad situation. No, dude, no. Fuck Levine, fuck him. And I'm so stoked that it was a bounce check, because dude, his little like hurrah to the boys about how he got that money, it's just so disgusting, dude, where he's just like, you know, I held up my pen and it was like the old days. I stared him in the eye for 15 minutes of silence and said, I don't want you to think about this. You know, put your name down, sign this piece of paper. Like, it's just gross. And I was just disgusted by it. And I'm so stoked that Levine got everything coming to him. And when, who was it? Who was the one who was actually, you know, finds out it's him?
It was Williamson.
It's Williamson.
Williamson. Right. Yeah.
Williamson finds out because Levine, you know, makes kind of a slip of the tongue a little bit and reveals, you know, it's this whole, it's a convoluted situation about how he gets caught a little bit, but not an unrealistic. I thought it was actually pretty nicely revealed. But when it's revealed and Williamson's like, no, I don't want your money. You know, I don't want your cut. You know, you can't bribe me out of this. You're going to get yours because I don't like you. And I'm just like, fuck yes, Williamson, get that man. Fuck that dude. So I had no sympathy towards him, and I was stoked.
Interesting. I definitely felt bad for him because I feel like of all the, I mean, I agree. Like there are no heroes in this story. The only innocent character that has a speaking line is this guy, I think Jack Link.
Jack Link
tries to cancel his sale that sets up the ending.
Yes, he does.
He's really the nicest guy, but of all the salespeople, you know, I wasn't happy that like Williamson got his comeuppance. Like that guy was a bastard too.
Yeah. So
it was really hard to root for any of them.
Fair.
Yeah.
No, it is. But yeah, and to your point, when poor little Jack comes in and says, my wife just, you know, we can't do it. My wife tells me I need my money back, please. Like he's just begging these guys to give him his goddamn check. And what does Levine do? Levine instantly sees the situation, goes to Buddy, his fellow real estate agent, and starts acting like a fellow rich client to make him feel comfortable with. I mean, he just goes right in. It's so smooth and disgusting. So anyways, no sympathy towards,
like,
yeah,
nothing but liars. Like they're all lying constantly. And even Williamson, when he basically figures out that Levine is the robber, he does it through a lie. He lies and says that he took the check, took Jack Link's check, and he didn't actually do it. And that like sets up the whole Levine reveal. I don't know. Other kind of like favorite moment, I think, was when Link sits down with Roma and is like, what does he say? He's like, I can't talk with you. I can't negotiate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is like so sad.
My wife says I can't talk to you. I need to call the district attorney or something like that. Yeah. Jack's character is so dope. And I loved him. And I don't honestly recall him in the movie, but I hope that he was done well.
He's done well. He's done well.
Before, I do want to touch a little bit on the movie, but the only thing that I would also, you know, to this play's point is these characters, and this is early 80s. So I don't think that there's a lot of kind of sympathy of the times. They're all so fucking racist, Sam.
Oh, yeah.
Blatant straight up racism towards any, you know, what do we get? We get Indian hate.
We get a lot of Chinese hate.
We get Chinese hate, of course. We get, don't we get like Eastern European? Do we get Polish?
Probably.
I mean, it's the whole gamut of hate. And so
you get a lot of C-word bombs, you know. So some pretty intense sexism.
So just fuck all these guys, man. Just let them eat each other and burn.
Yeah, I think when this play was revived, I was reading some articles that Mamet ended up taking out the little bit about, there's a whole sequence that then gets a callback with an Indian family and the Indian family not being able to like pay anything. And that gets like cut out of a later stage adaptation.
Give me a little bit of refresher on what you just said.
Well, there's a moment where I think it's Moss and Aaron now, or whatever that character's name is. They're talking about the Patels, and he makes a disparaging remark about like, oh, the Patels, like,
right,
they're dog shit or something, you know. And then he gets a lead from the Patel later from one of the Patels later in the play. So it's like it's this whole like circular, and there was controversy around it. Like when it was revived 10 years ago, and Mamet clipped out that part or maybe he changed it to something else. But I would be curious to see if like all the like
Chinese slurs also got removed, because it's pretty widespread.
Yeah, no, it's prevalent. Well, let's compare the movie, and I know you're extremely fresh. I have not seen this movie since I was, you know, unfortunately, in some ways, very stoned in college and really don't remember quite a bit. I remember the real estate office scenes quite a bit. Of course, remember Alec Baldwin's dynamic character, but don't remember too much else. So do you want to kind of give your kind of compare contrast in terms of pros, cons?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fairly faithful adaptation. The big change, there's some small details about the ending, that some lines that have been clipped. There's some scenes that have been reordered a little bit in the first act, but they add this whole character. I forgot what Alec Baldwin's character's name is, but he's basically a representative from the administration of Mitch and Murray, who come in and, like, he's basically the big bad. And in that scene, I mean, that scene's, like, very iconic. It's clipped out on YouTube, turned into memes and stuff. And his performance is just so good. And he looks so, I mean, he's like Alec Baldwin in his absolutely most alpha. And yes, all the other salespeople just look like small, you know, even though they're like, they're some pretty powerful male actors. You know what I mean? It's like, but they just look shriveled in that moment. But then there's also something that I was struck by, in watching that scene in particular, in contrasting with the book, you know, like you're saying, the stage direction is very minimalist in the play. So you really have to visualize the setting 100%. And I guess I'm just not very good at that. So I was kind of visualizing it as just people talking in space. Like, I didn't really have, like, a sense of background.
Interesting.
I mean, you know, I just very vague, like nothing specific. But with the movie, you're in the space, you're in their office, and it's called, like, Premier Properties, like, just such a bland name for a real estate group. And there's, like, these shitty little, like, posters on the wall, like, salesmen are born, not made, and, like, ABC always be closing, and, like, the shitty steak knives and the shitty red, like, everything looks so shitty. And so even though Baldwin is, like, dominant, and he's just, like, he's in for, like, 6 minutes and, like, putting up, like, 25 points on the board, you know, he also looks kind of pathetic, because the actual space is, I mean, this is all made up. It's so important to these guys' lives, but everything about this is made up. Like, the property isn't real. The board competition is just made up. I mean, it's real, but it's, like, it's a construct. And yet it's, like, completely controlling their emotions and their sense of self and self-worth. And I don't know. So that came out way more intensely when I was watching it than reading it.
Well, to your point about what, you know, the setting and visualizations, I very much not just voices talking, but I put them on an extremely minimal stage. Like, I pictured four actors, like, standing around, and just kind of, you know, suits and almost nothing on the stage talking. So that's kind of how I visualized it.
Same.
But I can dig placing it there. I do think the introduction of Alec Baldwin's character, as awesome as this, you know, it works for the film. You probably need that for film, but I think it kind of lessens the work a little bit for me. I don't know. I like that Williamson is as close as we get from that, like, ultimate evil or whatever of the upper bosses, and kind of having this go between kind of come in. I believe, if I remember the movie, he, like, introduces the competition, doesn't he? Like, he kind of lays it out there, whereas in the play, we're kind of already like pretty deep into the competition, I think.
A little unclear. He definitely sets up the competition. He's like, this is why we're doing it. But the board is already up there, and it already says Moss, like, X dollars, you know, Roma, $90,000 or whatever. So I'm not really sure what we're supposed to make of that.
Okay. Well, maybe he's just kind of the fire towards the end to kind of get a little push.
What he does do is he does threaten all the dudes who aren't on the board and says that if you don't sell by X time, you're going to be cut. So that's much more explicit.
And again, I don't know. I kind of like the idea that, well, I guess, doesn't Williamson in the play say things like, you know, you're going to get fired or whatever? Like, he kind of does lay down the hammer a little bit. But I like that these guys, again, these little kind of rats are kind of, in some ways, picturing their own demise about, hey, if I don't get up there, I'm going to, you know, get canned or whatever. When that's never really said to us, that if they don't, that they get fired or whatever. So I like that kind of paranoia. You know, not being laid out directly. But really, and again, it's been so long, so I have to rewatch, but Jack Lemmon as kind of our main protagonist, I know he's done a lot of great, I know he's very famous, didn't do it for me, man.
Really?
I know. And again, I have to rewatch, but especially, you know, at the time I was like, this character is just, it's kind of soft, and he's got these like mild ambitions, but it's kind of sniveling and whatever. And then through reading the play, I was kind of picturing him like, I think you could tackle that character in a lot of different ways. I think you could actually come at it from almost even like an Al Pacino-esque point of strength, like confidence, cockiness. I used to be like this and that or whatever, and I'm just kind of like, I think you can come at it a lot of ways. And for him to kind of come at it from what I remember as that really stereotypical, you brought up Death of a Salesman, but kind of like that sad Willie Loman, just, you know, defeated character. Yeah. I don't know, it just wasn't my favorite.
I thought it was strong. So if you rewatch it, I'd be interested to hear from you. It didn't bother me, but I especially, there was a couple of scenes that I thought he just nailed. Like there's a scene, I don't even know if it's in the play, where he goes to a guy's house and he tries to like wiggle his way in, and the guy is like just not having it. And then he like basically comes up with an excuse to push him out, Jack Lemmon. And I thought that was like, I mean, it's another really defeated, pathetic, play, right? But then all of that happens, and when he comes back to the office and he's on cloud nine because he like sold 80,000, it's like, right. I do appreciate that contrast. But yeah, I mean, for me, like the winners of the movie, I don't know if Jack Lemmon would be my winner. I almost feel like you could argue at Alec Baldwin, just because that scene is like one of the most famous from the movie, and it's they ended up reinserting it into the play. Like some theaters will like do this play, and they'll just take the screenplay of that scene and like insert it into the script. So
they
that,
really, huh?
Yeah, yeah. Because it's like become more iconic than the stage play. I would go with Al Pacino. I think Al Pacino, I kind of underrate him in my brain. And I thought he made that character make sense to me. In a way that when I was reading it, I was like, I don't really know what this guy's doing. But I thought the way he goes a little over the top, I mean, he always goes into like overacting territory. And I thought it worked really well. I don't know.
You know, towards that, you know, we mentioned Alec Baldwin's kind of, but to the characters that actually exist in the play, first off, was the screenplay done by Mamet? Did he transition it to film?
That's a good question.
Really, my real question is, are there snippets of dialogue straight from the play
taken? Oh, yes, definitely. So, I mean, yeah, there are definitely moments where it's like straight from the play. And I do think he wrote the screenplay.
Okay. And how
it happens if somebody else like, you know, restructures it or adds their own scenes, but I think he did it.
And there are multiple instances of again, these folks kind of going on these long tirades. Does it hold true to that? Like, are there some like, you know, speeches basically given by, like, does Roma give his Chinese restaurant sales speech of wildness?
Oh, yeah. And it's really good. Really good.
That's strong.
It makes so much more sense when it's, I mean, because like, you know, the actor is like adding all these inflection points and just like pacing it really well. And then he has the prop. You see him bring out the brochure, and the brochure is like so shitty, and it's just, it looks so weak, but it's, you're just so entranced by him. So it's amazing.
That is incredible. And that made me want, you know, when I was reading it, And I'd love your take on it because you're more, you know, affluent to these to plays in general. But when I was reading some of these long, like soliloquies or whatever, I was wondering, like, does Mamet expect when this is put on as a production for them to just stick exactly to these speeches, or is this kind of rambling? Like, does it open the door for not improvisation, but like tweaks to the script, if you will, or does, I don't know if that makes any sense. I mean,
yeah, totally. I mean, I don't
try to play.
I would imagine that he's pretty like stick to my fucking words. You know, it seems like he's that kind of guy. But he overwrites so much that he'll add like a character stuttering, or like he'll start a sentence in the middle of a sentence, so you don't really know who the subject of the sentence is. You're just hearing the verb, so you kind of have to infer this stuff. So I was noticing, I was like reading along when I went to the script when I was watching the movie, and there were little changes like to small words that don't change the meaning, or you know, just little transitional words that I assume were just changed because like it was more natural for Al Pacino to say like to pause here or to like, you know, and that shit is probably, I mean, that happens all the time, but because you want the performance to be true. So,
yeah, I mean, yeah, to your point, he wrote the words for a reason. He wants them, each one is supposed to have their meaning or whatever. Anyways, I guess I've never really seen that done where a play is performed and some of the scenes are tweaked or whatever in terms of dialogue, but I mean, they're just so long that I almost feel bad for these actors. Like, I mean, that's impressive work to, if you can spit all of that, you know, word for word. Anyways, well, strong, strong choice, Sam. Really appreciate you bringing it to my attention. I had no idea that this was originally a play. Once you told it to me, it made complete sense because, if you know, watching the movie is strikingly play like in terms of lack of different settings, and so you know it's just so different than I guess in a classic Hollywood production, so it made total sense, and I thought it was extremely good. I was gonna say it was a great companion piece to the film. Other way around, I guess the film is a great companion piece, and solid. Any kind of final thoughts on this one?
No, I think I'm tapped out. I think I really enjoyed it. You know, like I said last week, love doing the plays because they're just one and done's. You know, you read them in 2 hours and you got a lot to talk about, and you know, there's a lot of comparisons to either movies or you know, productions if you've seen them. It's a lot of fun. But next week we'll be moving into a different book. I think we're going longer.
It is juicy. I agree. I think that plays can tackle like morality and depth of character really, really cool, and it's fun to talk about. We do kind of have an open week. So we'll talk maybe off pod a little bit about what we do, but maybe we'll share some more glimpses of the book club to come in the future. Sam, thank you so much for coming on the pod. Really appreciate you, big dog.
Yeah. Shout out to the Waiver Fire and all its fans. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Take care.